to murder you.
By the Soviet of the flower of the Polish nation. And even after victory had been achieved, we continued to supply the Soviet with quantities of war material despite the clear and inescapable warnings of the Soviet threat to future peace. In the East, we gave over to the Soviet control of the industrial resources of Manchuria, the area of North Korea, and the Kurils, pointed at the heart of the Japanese home island. We condemned our faithful wartime ally, the Chinese people, to the subjugation of communist tyranny. And in the course of these moves, we proceeded with precipitate haste to divest ourselves of our own military strength. Despite the threat to our security then clearly apparent, our executive flaunted and ignored the judgment and will of the Congress, which appropriated funds for the expansion of our air arm, which he arbitrarily refused to expend for such purpose. Small wonder, indeed, that from the combination of these tragic decisions and events, there occurred a reversal of the balance of world power such as history has never before recorded. Then suddenly, with our military strength standing at possibly the lowest relativity in history, our divisions in Japan reduced from 3 to 2 regiments, our regiments from 3 to 2 battalions, our battalions from 3 to 2 companies, with our protection withdrawn from South Korea as a militarily indefensible peninsula, we there and then plunged our forces into war to defend it. Few would take exception to the impulse, however idealistic, to support the preservation of freedom where we had done so much to implant the principles and spirit of freedom. But it is fatal to enter any war without the will to win it. Criticize not the morality of the decision, but its irresponsibility and recklessness. We defeated the North Korean armies, but when the communist armies of China struck, our leaders lacked the courage to fight to a military decision, even though victory was then readily within our grasp. A victory which would not only have discharged our commitment to the Korean people, but which in the long run might well have saved continental Asia from red domination. And after discarding victory as the military objective and thereby condemning our forces to a stalemated struggle of attrition, and the Korean nation and people to progressive obliteration, we again yielded to communist intrigue and entered into protracted armistice negotiations, even though every lesson of experience had clearly shown such negotiations to be but the means whereby such an enemy gains time to reinforce his military capabilities. While I have not been consulted with reference to Korea, since my retirement from active assignment 15 months ago, I can unhesitatingly say that a leadership which by weakness and indecision has brought about such a military dilemma lacks the soundness of vision, the moral courage, and the resolute will to resolve it. But resolved it must be, or we cannot long carry so intolerable a burden. We must have a leadership capable of decision, as indecision in war is but the prelude to disaster. No military problem is unsolvable. Korea stands today as the hallowed graveyard for countless American dead. We must not let it become as well a graveyard for American hope, American faith, and American honor. In Europe, and indeed throughout the world, our foreign policy approach has been equally as vacillating and negative, and for the most part, sad indeed to relate, under the domination of others. We have yielded to selfish pressures both at home and abroad, and in so doing have unduly directed the distribution of our wealth into privileged channels, have taken sides in international disputes which were fundamentally none of our affair, and have endeavored to impose our will on other nations' purely domestic problems in an imperialistic manner. We have ignored traditional friends while showering our favors on others, and we have lost that sense of judicial fairness which formerly characterized our relations abroad. In our preoccupation with Europe, we have tended to discard from our concern those great peoples of Asia and the Middle East who historically have sought not our wealth, but our friendship and understanding. Our good neighbor policy with respect to the peoples of Central and South America, of greater strategic concern than all others, has been largely subordinated through the paternalistic attitude which has dominated our material assistance abroad. We have promoted as much weakness as strength, as much resentment as friendship. Animated by the doubtful belief that with money alone we could erect internal bulwarks against communism's growth, our leaders have expended much of our resource on the area of Western Europe. Events have largely established the fallacy of this reasoning. Indeed, the history of mankind shows clearly that the love of liberty is a spiritual resource of the human heart, which, if non-existent, does not spring from money alone. None will quarrel with the impulse to do all reasonably within our power to assist the best effort of the peoples of Western Europe to prepare their bastions for self-defense. But communism, with its recently acquired strategic frontiers in Asia and Europe, and its penetration elsewhere by internal minority influences, presents a worldwide problem, the solution of which involves consideration of every point of possible communist pressure. One would be foolhardy indeed to quench a fire in the kitchen while leaving another room aflame. The problem is global, not sectional. Or would the free world be the gainer if our own nation, from its conception in liberty, has ever stood as a beacon of hope and inspiration should so exhaust itself of spiritual and material resource as to render its own survival subject to the will of others. Such a tragedy would return civilization to the darkness of the Middle Ages, and the ideal of human liberty might perish from the earth. But the present administration ignores the lessons of history, however clear and unmistakable. It ignores the practical aspect that there is a limit even to our own vast resources. It ignores the fact that our potential strength rests not so much upon any natural advantages which we have and others have not, but upon the initiative and vision, the enterprise and courage, the sweat and toil which alone spring from the incentive of freedom. Destroy such incentive, and our nation can go the way of many others toward a universal level of mediocrity, a standard of life measured by the lowest common denominator, which is communism's ultimate goal. The administration is obsessed by the idea that we can spend ourselves into a position of leadership abroad just as it believes we can spend ourselves into prosperity at home. Both are based upon illusory premises. Both challenge economic and social truths deeply rooted in the experience of mankind. World leadership can only rest upon world respect. Such respect is one of those spiritual ideals which do not result from gifts, propaganda, salesmanship, or any artificial means. It is not for barter to the highest bidder. It is not within the orbit of international trade. It is influenced solely by the soundness of the ideas by which we better our own civilization, elevate to higher standards our own way of life, and strengthen the dignity of our own citizenry. Only through the exemplification of sound ideas, which in the crucible of experience have produced for us a better and more serene life, may we contribute in fullest measure to the well-being of others. The higher our own standard and more stable we become, the greater our appeal to less fortunate peoples, and the more they will look to us and our ways for guidance and leadership. This applies equally to those behind the Iron Curtain and those still blessed by the concept of human freedom. For the whole record of civilization proves that the tyranny has not as yet been devised which can long resist a sound idea. Spiritually and physically, we possess the resource, properly conserved and realistically applied, to lead toward a world freed from the exhausting wars which have so plagued the past. This is a practical purpose, not visionary, for the destructiveness of modern war has now in the atomic age become too frightful to contemplate by even a potential victor. This, then, must be the direction of our foreign policy. We must, upon restoration of our military strength and spiritual balance recklessly dissipated in our headlong retreat from victory, chart from that strength a true and unequivocal course to peace and tranquility, a peace and tranquility which will be real, not fictitious, deep-rooted, not superficial. Our ideal must be eventually the abolition of war. Such is the longing hope of all of the masses of mankind of whatever race or tribe. Indeed, so well is this understood that even the despot, in order to assure a following, cloaks the threat or application of force with a hypocritical pretense that his purpose is to secure the peace. But rarely has the present administration made a major move calculated to strengthen the fabric of world peace. To the contrary, it has done much to advance the danger of global strife by its indecisive conduct of the campaign in Korea, with its shameful implication that we dare not strike back at those who strike at us. By its bellicose attitude toward all who oppose it in international diplomacy, and by its pattern of collective security agreements, which, without as yet having mounted either the will or the physical power to successfully meet aggression, have divided the world into armed camps and rendered us dependent not alone upon the wisdom of our own foreign policy to keep us out of war, but upon the foreign policies and diplomatic moves of other nations as well. We must fully understand that once we commit ourselves to the defense of others, the issue of war or peace is no longer in our exclusive hands, or we become but another pawn in the game of international power politics, a dangerous game in which the present administration has demonstrated no peculiar adeptness. It has talked and pledged peace while moving toward war. Indeed, none can deny what history so clearly records, that the Democratic Party has well earned the doubtful distinction of being a war party of modern American politics. The dead of World War I, of World War II, and of the Korean War render mute testimony. We must remain faithful to the commitments we have made to others so long as they remain faithful to theirs made to us. But failure of the principle of collective security in Korea, where we have found ourselves holding responsibility without corresponding authority, plainly warns that too much must not be expected from collective security elsewhere. Indeed, in Western Europe, as in Korea, experience has shown a reluctance by many of the Allies to assume a fair and rightful share of the military burden, even though in the case of Western Europe, the basic purpose would be the defense of its own soil. This hesitancy does not spring from any insufficiency of manpower, nor the exhaustion of other needed resource, but rather from a seeming confident assurance that this nation's blood and treasure will be committed to the fullest extent needed to accomplish the military objective. The free peoples of Asia and the Middle East do not ask for American garrisons to defend their soil. All they seek is the necessary military equipment beyond their own capacity of production. They have both the will and the adequate men, if properly equipped, themselves to conduct their defense and to turn the tide decisively against communism. There is no logical reason why the same solution should not apply with respect to all others. In such circumstance, it should be our unalterable purpose to effect in due time withdrawal of our ground garrisons from service abroad. By far, our nation's greatest resource is our youth. In 20 bitter campaigns, I have witnessed its magnificence in the most trying experience of all, that of the battlefield. It has never failed our faith, never failed an invincible courage and a patriotism which subordinated life itself to duty. Yet as it now approaches the responsibility of civic leadership, it is confronted with a situation made almost desperate by the loss of such opportunity and resource as was our own heritage from the past. This is the greatest tragedy of all, that a national administration could have so yielded to the disease of power as to betray the youth of America. Despite stresses and strains, the fine basic character of the American people remains unimpaired. It offers hope that under the inspiration of a strong moral leadership, the people, all the people, will hurl back insidious efforts to sow the seeds of suspicion, distrust, and hatred calculated not only to stir up racial or religious strife between the several segments of our society, but to destroy the unity and common understanding which has been the cornerstone to our growth as a nation. The very survival of our liberties, and indeed our civilization, is dependent upon our citizenry of all races, creeds, and colors, standing firmly and invincibly together with a singleness of purpose, a mutuality of faith, and a common prayer, God bless America. It is this spiritual unity which offers assurance that the coming crusade to rechart the nation's course toward peace and security and prosperity will find an aroused countryside ready and eager to march. That crusade rests upon the humanitarian aspirations of mankind, its constitutional rights, and the moral necessity for human happiness. Demands a purification of the nation's conscience and a refortification of its will and faith. Therein lies the Republican Party's challenge to leadership. At the close of the Constitutional Convention, George Washington remarked to Benjamin Franklin that he believed the Constitution as finally evolved was a great and noble charter of liberty upon which the several states could rally, unite, and prosper. Yes, General Franklin responded, if we can make it work. We have made it work in the days of our great past, and come November, we will make it work again. Help us, God.
Before General MacArthur entered, but it was apparent that a great many of the spectators must have been out visiting the refreshment stands in the corridors just outside the main auditorium, because we couldn't see a seat vacant while the general was speaking. A good many of the delegates now moving out of their chairs and not moving into the aisles for any sort of real demonstration. They seem to be moving toward the back of the hall as if they were going to leave when the miscellaneous business, that is the last item on the program this evening, is done. There's not going to be the kind of rip-roaring demonstration in the aisles for General MacArthur, the kind that is usually made after the nominating speeches for each of the candidates. Harold Stassen, wearing a brown business suit, the brown tie, has made his way somehow to the runway. In the midst of the crush, he's shaking hands with General MacArthur and congratulating him. General MacArthur, of course, is Harold Stassen's old boss when Mr. Stassen was a naval officer in the Pacific. Joe Martin, the permanent chairman who won't be installed until tomorrow, is there too. In the crush, and now the general has broken clear of all the obstacles and all the traffic, and he is leaving in an opposite direction. He's coming out, going to leave the hall apparently just underneath this radio booth. He came in the rear entrance, you know, marched all the way down the center aisle, made that great entrance, and now he is departing behind the face of Abraham Lincoln, which is just underneath this radio booth and is just directly in front of one of the rails of one of the balconies, all decorated in red, white, and blue bunting. Leaving the hall very quickly after his speech, much more quickly than many people thought. Now, here's Dallas Townsend.
Well, the delegates are still absorbing the effects of that speech by General MacArthur, a keynoter, which, as Bill Downs said before he made it, was going to be a humdinger, and it certainly was. Now, we'll be back in a minute, but first, let's swing over to Olin Tice for
the speaker's platform. The lights dimming out slowly, the movie lights down there in the auditorium. Senator Capehart of Indiana was recognized by Chairman Hallinan. Senator Capehart made a motion that the convention should stand adjourned until 11:30 tomorrow morning, Chicago time, 12:30 Eastern Daylight Time. It didn't take long for the delegates who were already clogging the aisles to shout aye. Just before that, though, Chairman Hallinan announced a meeting of the Committee on Rules in the Havana Room of the Blackstone Hotel immediately following this session. That means in about 30 minutes when the delegates get back into Midtown Chicago. So you can see the business of the convention goes on sometimes far into the night, even while sessions are not being held here in the auditorium. Well, it has been a great night indeed. The keynote night always is at a convention. The first evening session, the convention is just beginning to roll. People are beginning to get the feeling of it. The permanent chairman won't be installed until tomorrow, and this was the first big night. A number of us CBS reporters and correspondents have been watching the speech, listening to the speech as it was made from various parts of the hall. And so we're going to have a little talk here in the CBS radio booth and see what we all thought of it. I might start off myself by simply saying that it seemed to me a great deal like most keynote speeches, as a matter of fact, especially if you read it before you heard General MacArthur read it. I think the special qualities came from General MacArthur's personality, the fact that it was he himself delivering it, special qualities from his own special delivery and his vocabulary. The attacks on the opposition, I think, were similar to those many of the other party orators make, and I think that that's particularly noticeable, as I say, when you read the speech. It seemed to me that General MacArthur viewed with alarm, but did almost no pointing with pride. He flayed the Democrats without giving very much praise to the achievements of the Republicans, and in all these things, therefore, I think it was pretty much a standard keynote speech with, of course, the special MacArthur touches. Now, Edward P. Morgan, you're here with me in the booth, having come up from the stage where you heard the speech. Do you agree? What do you think of it?
Bob, in an atmosphere charged and drenched with emotion, such as this one has been, the applause which was given to the general on his entrance into the hall and the sustained applause during the speech, it's hard for a reporter to sit down and try to sort out some cold facts objectively about the significance of what General MacArthur said. But perhaps two things of significance come from what he did not say rather than what he did. For instance, he did not say anything that would either rule him out or thrust him forward as a candidate for the presidency as a party nominee himself. He still remains a possible dark horse, and his presence here today has been the occasion for many of his backers to get out and plump for him. The second thing involves whether his stand of criticism would be very obvious against General Eisenhower. He did not, as some thought he might, lash out directly against General Eisenhower, his former subordinate and a man against whom he is supposed to harbor still a feeling of bitter rivalry and jealousy. There was one part in the speech which could possibly be equated as a statement beamed directly or indirectly at the general when he said, "We foolishly permitted the encirclement of Berlin by Soviet forces, rendering almost inevitable the tragically high cost we have had to pay to secure lines of security and trap communication between our zones in Germany."